Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our listening audience, both in the radio and online, and we welcome you all to visit www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Bruce Kane, who is the director of the Washington Center of the UC Berkeley campus and is a longtime observer of California politics and is here to enlighten us on how we're going to change the way things are. Professor Bruce Kane.
Well, the knowing laugh, I think, tells us all where we are right now. There might have been a time when I thought I had solutions, but first of all, let me say that it's always fun to give a talk here. This is about the third or fourth time I've spoken at the Commonwealth Club, and I always have a good time. And I'm looking forward to your questions. Let me just do one little correction, and that is the UC Washington Center, even though we'd like to think of it as a Berkeley operation, those of us from Berkeley, it isn't. It's a UC operation. We have students from all nine campuses that have undergraduates. We have 900 students a year that come and take classes and do internships in Washington, and we also run conferences and serve as a housing facility for both the students and the faculty. So if you're ever in D.C., and you want to see something of the University of California that's really turned out to be quite a gem, the University of California's center, UCDC, it's on Scott Circle. And as I said, it's many students. We have one here who will tell you that for many of the students it's a transformative experience. Well, with that little correction, let me just get started. In my dual life as somebody who's running a program for the University of California in Washington, and as one who is still an employee of the University of California and comes back to California regularly, I can tell you that misery now comes in stereo. There was a time, I think 10 years ago, when we thought California was unique in its dysfunction, that the state of paralysis that we had was due to the unique features of our institutions, in particular the supermajority rules, the abuse of the initiative system, and the fact that we have a very diverse state with extremely wide range of political views. But, come to the present, and you read the headlines in D.C., and it's hard to believe that the situation is any less dysfunctional right now in California. I mean, in D.C. as it is in California. And I think we're probably in for a period of continued dysfunction over the next few years in D.C. If you look at what's happening, if you've been following the Republican debates, it's pretty clear that the lines that are being drawn in the sand are quite polarized, quite different. And while there's a super committee that's supposed to be trying to come to some agreement, most of the thinking inside D.C. is that that super committee will probably fail. It will fail not only because the lobbyists are lobbying very hard and most of the members on the super committee have strong ties to the lobbyists, but it will fail because there are fundamentally different conceptions on the Democratic and Republican side about how to move forward. And you have, in addition, an election coming up in a year and a half, where people have expectations that the election will solve everything, that we will basically clear the boards, give a clear mandate of what we want, and the country will proceed. And that's basically what's going on. Washington's thinking, why decide now when we can decide later, and the election will give us some clues. Now, again, the knowing laugh suggests that you will all see the flaws with that logic. Flaw number one being that if indeed the most likely outcome at this point is that we will get a continuation of some form of divided government. That is to say, Obama has probably better than a 50-50, not much better, but a better than a 50-50 chance of holding on to the presidency, and we'll have a situation similar to what we had in the 90s with a Republican-held Congress, because most likely the Republicans will take the Senate because they've got more seats exposed on the Democratic side than the Republican side. So you're looking at a situation of either divided government with a Democratic president and a Republican Congress, or you're looking at a situation of a Republican-controlled Congress and a Republican-controlled presidency, but with the filibuster in place, we've discovered that unless the Republicans can completely get a filibuster-proof Senate, then the Senate will become basically the focal point of negotiations between the Congress and the presidency. And, of course, only a couple years ago, people in San Francisco and elsewhere were saying, why is the Senate allowed to do these supermajority rules? I predict that if Obama loses, people in San Francisco will be saying, thank God the Senate has supermajority rules. It's one of these things about institutions that when you're in one position, you look at them one way, and when you're in another position, you look at them that way. And, of course, that doesn't do any good. You really have to try to step back and ask what's best, but we don't do that. So what's interesting is that this phenomena of polarization, the problem of fiscal choices and what you do when the economy is stalled out and likely to be stalled out. I go to these Brookings lunches, and there's nothing terribly hopeful from the Brookings economists. They seem to believe that we're probably in this for 3 or 4 more years at a minimum. So we're in for bitter politics based on a stalled out economy. The interesting thing is that in Washington, nobody's really questioning the system as a whole, partly because even if they did, there's not much you can do about it, because the constitutional route for changing aspects of the constitution or the structure of government is incredibly arduous. There are 4 different paths, and all of them require supermajority votes and consent of the states and consent of the Congress or conventions. And so nobody thinks that that's plausible, and so people tend to focus more on the politics than on the structure. Whereas in California, because it's so easy to change the system, when we're unhappy with our politics, the first thing we want to do is change it. And Lord knows we've changed it many times. The Constitution, which was written in the late 19th century, it was a populist document, has been amended over 435 times. I've lost track at this point as to how many times we've actually changed it, but we've changed it hundreds of times. And so when we have discontent with our politics, we look to make a change. We do some sort of engineering. And so the latest things that we're trying are a citizen redistricting commission and a top two primary. And the idea is that the combination of these institutions will produce many more centrists who will bring the glue to the government that will allow us to negotiate again. And I have an open mind about it, but to be honest, my prior expectation on this going in is that if there's any effect, it's going to be on the margins, that the causes of polarization are much deeper. And to simply change the nomination process and to change the redistricting process only affects things on the margin. That's not to say that it won't have any effect or it isn't worth doing, but it is to say that if you're putting your expectations on those reforms to make a massive difference, you're going to be disappointed. I mean, we've already seen that the redistricting commission is embroiled in its own controversy, been sued by the Republicans. They're extremely unhappy with the result. There's a possibility that the minority groups are unhappy. And with the top two, we simply don't know whether the system will manipulate the rules such that what seems in theory as a possibility that it will produce a more moderate set of candidates, we'll find won't actually operate that way. So what this has led to in California is the question of whether, somebody at the Berkeley Breakfast Club put it, whether we should burn the wagons and start from scratch, or whether we should pursue a policy of incremental reform. So I want to talk about, first of all, what are the problems with burning the wagons and replacing what we have with something new? And secondly, if we don't burn the wagons, what are our options? And thirdly, what are the prospects of doing anything politically given the way the situation is? And then I will open up to questions either about what I say or what I don't say or what's on your mind, and I'll do the best I can to answer those questions. So blowing up the boxes or burning the wagons or whatever metaphor you want to use for completely starting anew, This was an idea that was very popular about a year and a half ago. And you remember the Bay Area Council, among other groups, was talking the talk of constitutional reform. And I was asked to be on the advisory council, the academic advisory council, and while I was very skeptical of these ideas, I thought, well, you know, I'd like to listen in. I'd like to hear what they're thinking. Now, the real problem with constitutional reform is that, well, there are two parts. Part number one is that it's increasingly hard to do constitutional reform, not just in California, but in all states. And number two, and perhaps more importantly, you can't blow up the boxes without knowing what box you're going to put in its place. And to be honest, there are so many candidates of what people want to put in its place, there's no consensus that if we were to blow up the boxes, we'd find ourselves in pretty much the same situation that we're in already. Namely, we can't agree. Okay? So let's start with the first point. The first point is that constitutional reform in this country has ground to a halt. If you go back into the 19th century and the 20th century, states were constantly revising their state constitutions. There are states that have had 8, 9, 10 constitutions. There are states that have mandatory constitutional conventions, or at least the consideration of possibility of conventions. And that activity was at its peak in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and you had a lot of new constitutions. As you know, in California, the last attempt at constitutional reform, serious attempt, was in the 90s. We have two options. We have a constitutional convention option, and we have something called the Constitutional Revision Commission, which then has to, which is appointed by various elected officials and then reports to the legislature, and the legislature then either votes for it or votes against it, and then it's put on the ballot. And you may recall that in the early 90s, the Constitutional Revision Commission met. It had a lot of interesting, fairly radical ideas about how to change California. The composition of the legislature changed. The Republicans took control of the Assembly, and they immediately pulled the plug on the Constitutional Revision Commission, and it died. It left behind some documents, including a book that we, a number of us that were on the Academic Advisory Council, did. So I got something out of it. But the state got nothing out of it, and the whole effort died until the Bay Area Council took up this process about 2 years ago. Now, it's not surprising that the Bay Area Council proposal died. It's not surprising given that since 1984, there is no state that has successfully changed its constitution. And if you read the accounts of attempts to change their constitutions, they sound a lot like the accounts that we have here. Namely, when you put a constitutional change, especially a comprehensive one, on the table, everybody looks at the piece that affects them. And so what you get are a lot of people that say, wait a minute, I like this, but I don't like that. And so the synthetic logic of a constitutional change butts up against the extremely parochial and strong pressures of interest group politics in America. And so what happens is that ultimately the proposals die. The other problem with these is that constitutional conventions were in their heyday when there was a belief that some educated, wise individuals could be set aside to think about what was best for the state. And then their expertise would be deferred to, and people would vote for that. And today's populism is such that not only is political science expertise questioned, which is perfectly understandable, but even scientific expertise is questioned in the modern era. And there's some basis to that, which is that expertise is not value neutral. That is, you know, you can talk about how governments operate, but then when you make recommendations, you have to make normative judgments about who should have power and how much equality should be and what's the nature of accountability in the system. And once you start making normative judgments, then, expertise becomes more than just value-free facts. It becomes some imposition of what your view or vision of fairness is or accountability is. So constitutional reform is basically impossible to do across the country, so it shouldn't be surprising that it's impossible to do in California. And then it makes it even worse if you decide that you're going to do something radical like choose people by lottery. So the answer of the Bay Area Council was, well, we're not going to choose notables because who will trust them? We're not going to choose government officials because they're the problem. So what are we going to do? We're going to choose a number of citizens by random lottery, and we're going to pay them for a year to think about politics. And, of course, then you stop and think about that. Wait a minute. Several hundred random Californians, you know, you'd have to drug test them. You'd have to make sure that they weren't completely insane. You know, think of the recall in 2003, and remember the 100 and so candidates that ran. We had porn stars. We had, random citizens who'd never voted before. We had all kinds of people that came out of the woodwork to run. And is that, if we don't trust expertise, does it mean that we trust complete ignorance? I mean, is that where we go? That somehow having a blank slate is better than people that have expertise? And while people thought about that for a moment, and believe it or not, the people in the Bay Area Council, they're not a bunch of fools, and they really seriously were invested in that idea. And some of us on the academic side were going, whoa, this is really strange, but I have to study strange things. That's my whole career, so I'm going to stay on the advisory council and take notes. But whoa, I had a plan to get my name off of that if it had gone forward. But they made a hard situation worse by being, I think, adopting some ideas that were just frankly crazy. That never helps. So constitutional reform is very hard. But the second point, the first major point is that it's hard to do. The second major point is it's not clear that you want to do it if there's no underlying consensus. And if you think about, I would go to these forums on constitutional reform and I'd say, well, what's wrong with California? What are we doing with California? And some people would say, well, we need proportional representation. And some people would say, no, we don't. And some people would say, we need to fix the term limit problem. Some people say, no, we need to go to a part-time legislature. And some people would say we need a majority vote for the budget so that there's real accountability. And other people say, no, we don't. We got to make sure that nobody ever raises taxes ever. And on and on and on and on. So here's the problem. The problem is if there's no underlying agreement in a group or in a society, how do you impose rules on that, especially when everybody knows that those rules have consequences? So take the majority vote. You know, I've been in academic forums where all of us understand, lots of things about theories of government. And my friends who happen to be very conservative Republicans say, I don't want to – yes, I believe that democracy is about a majority vote, but I'm not going to go for a majority vote because a majority vote simply means we'll get more taxes. And I prioritize my policy preference over any kind of fuzzy-wuzzy notions about democratic accountability. And so the conversation ends. So the point is there's – I'm going to use a social science term that, is probably unnecessary, but we use it all the time. It's called endogeneity, which is to say that the rules and the politics are connected, interconnected, and you can't separate them. And so what you want in terms of policies is connected to what you want in terms of the structure. And so trying to separate that out and say, no, the structure is something we're all going to agree to without knowing the consequences on policy, that's really hard to do in the modern era because everybody, to use the Rawlsian metaphor of making choices behind the veil of ignorance, everybody is peeking their head around the curtain, right? All the time. So constitutional reform, blowing up the boxes, hard to do if you really don't know what you want in the end. If you fundamentally your problem is you can't agree that there's huge divisions in that society, then constitutional reform is just going to replicate all those divisions and all those parochial concerns. It's not going to solve it. So are there things that we can do? Yes, there are. Basically, the people down at Stanford and the California Forward people have done a diligent job of doing these deliberative polls where they get citizens and they capture them for 3 days and they barrage them with information and they say, what are you willing to vote for? And, I mean, the bottom line is that people aren't willing to make fundamental changes. You know, if you put them into a group and you discuss for 3 days what you're going to do, you're going to get marginal changes. But marginal changes are worth doing. In the end, we're going to be happier when the economy recovers and we can forget our problems. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make changes, because ironically, we make most of our mistakes when times are good. We either give away money in the form of tax expenditures, or we commit to programs that we can't pay for. And so we create our problems when there are good times, and then we're in a panic trying to solve the problems when there are bad times, when everybody's angry and scared. And, you know, in the end, I fear the recovery as much as I fear the lack of recovery, because we're going to make some set of bad decisions again that we'll then pay for the next time the revenues go down. And, of course, in California, the revenues now for state government are much more volatile than they were before Prop 13 in 1978, because we're much more dependent on pro-cyclical taxes like sales taxes and income taxes and money from stock options. So when the economy goes bad, the revenues go down. So the fundamental challenge in California is, how do you provide for a steady level of services when you've got a volatile revenue stream? And that is the fundamental challenge. Now, the federal government can run deficits. That's not going to happen at the state level for obvious reasons. So how do you do it? So anyway, there are four things that I think are worth thinking about. They're not going to dramatically and magically take California out of its dysfunctional state, but they will, on the margin, improve things. First is, we need to improve legislative capacity. If you think of the cycle of how we get into trouble because the legislature fails to do something, and then the people decide to try to fix it, or, shall we say, some interest groups put something on the ballot, which they then entice people to vote for. And usually the fixes fix some things, but they create other problems. So they either mandate expenditures for particular programs, or they appropriate taxes for particular programs, and they decrease the flexibility of the budget-making process, or they create expectations that can't be met. There are just 101 reasons why ballot box budgeting is problematic. And the PPIC and various groups have asked people, you know, what do you know about the budget? And, of course, people don't know anything. They think the number one item in the budget is prisons. No, it happens to be education, K-12 education. You know, so how do you make a decision if you don't really know the basic facts about the budget? And yet we're asking citizens to make these budgetary decisions because we don't believe in the capacity of the legislature. So step one is, we need to restore legislative capacity. What does that mean? Number one, we have to lengthen term limits. Right now we have excessive chaos. We have too many people moving in and out. And, this is one of the problems I had with the Citizen Redistricting Commission, was that it was almost like they were bragging about the fact that they got rid of a lot of incumbents in the legislature. But we already have 30 or 40% turnover in the legislature of incumbents. So all you've done is increased the chaos up there. And, when you arrive in Sacramento, running this state is actually quite complicated. The budget is quite long. It's quite detailed. And it's quite complex. And it takes you a couple years to figure out what that process is. And if we're bringing people up, educating them in 2 years, and then showing them the door, you know, they get 2 years maybe of the six where they can actually govern. Then they're looking in the last 2 years for their next job. You know, so they're out raising money from the interest groups who will tell them what to think. So, you know, why do we think that creating more chaos is going to make for better legislative capacity? I don't get it. We also need to do more in terms of oversight. People think that there's 40% waste and fraud out there. That's the number that comes out. Well, you know, there's waste and fraud in every organization, and particularly in governments, but it isn't 40%. And we're going to begin to see, on a lot of different fronts, that when you cut budgets as drastically as you are doing right now, it's going to affect real services. And I can tell you, in the trenches at the University of California, we are fundamentally a different place than we were 20 or 30 years ago. We've lost over $600 million, and we're about to lose another $100 million because of, shall we say, some wishful thinking on the part of Jerry Brown and the Democrats about this, where revenue was going to come. So you can't take $750 million out of the University of California system without fundamentally changing the way it operates. And I will be glad to go into great detail about how that has changed. But if we had better oversight and more transparency about how government money is spending, if we did better evaluation of those programs, if we put it in the hands of a body that perhaps was publishing reports, the Hoover Commission should be, you know, given steroids and given much more of a chance to look into the way money is spent, so that people can we can sunset programs we don't need, so we can actually expose what programs are doing and what good they've done and measure that. If we can start to do that, maybe we can start to win people's confidence back that government is actually doing something. And so I believe that restoring legislative capacity, doing the oversight, doing the evaluations, a nonpartisan staff, get back to keeping the staff out of the political game business and raising money business, and increasing term limits are step number one. Step number two is reforming the initiative process. This is going to be hard to do because reforming the initiative process is not popular with people. People love the right to change things at the ballot box through initiatives. But it is very clear that some subject matter would be better not dealt with through the initiative process. And most states, we have the most user-friendly initiative process. It's been totally professionalized. You got enough money, you can get anything on the ballot through paid signature gatherers. And there are subjects like the budget that shouldn't be on the ballot. You can't make sequential decisions about how to commit money without thinking about how the whole fits together, and yet that's what we're doing. We're mandating expenditures, we're earmarking monies, and not really at each one of the decisions may be rational or interesting, but we're basically making it very hard for ourselves to deal with any kind of crisis and to deal with the volatility and the revenues that we're talking about. So we need to do initiative reform. Thirdly, we need to do tax reform. We have whole parts of the economy that are not paying taxes. And increasingly, as we've moved away from manufacturing and as we've moved to a more internet economy, a lot of that money is just not there. And so we're taxing certain parts of the economy quite a bit to sustain the fact that we're not getting money from other parts of the economy. That's going to be very hard. I mean, Schwarzenegger had the tax commission that produced a plan for something like a value-added tax that's used in Europe, and that thing died really fast because of all the political forces that I was talking about before. But it needs to be done at some point. And then lastly, something that I think is Jerry Brown has talked about, and I hope he doesn't lose the focus on that, which is the local state government responsibilities and figuring out a way to make local governments more accountable for their programming, restoring their ability to raise the money they need for the services that they want. Right now, we've got this completely dysfunctional fiscal federalism where the state government raises the money through income taxes and sales taxes and redistributes that money back to replace the property tax money that was taken away from the local governments. And plus, we've added two-third vote requirements and other kinds of restrictions on the capacity of local governments to raise money. It seems to me kind of outrageous for the state as a whole to impose limitations on local governments. If Contra Costa County or Marin County wants to say that it requires a supermajority vote to raise revenue, then fine. But why does the state as a whole get to dictate what a local jurisdiction does? And, you know, the interesting thing is, and I'm not sure that it's completely recognized, the growth in total government spending in California has largely been at the local government level. It's not the state government level. And this was the problem that Meg Whitman was going on and on about, you know, state government. It turns out that in terms of the number of state employees per capita and in terms of expenditure per capita on state government, we're not a high-spending state, and we're near the bottom in terms of the number of state employees. Where the growth has been at the local government level, and of course, and then add the kind of pension scandals that we've seen, local governments, giving away lots of pension money, and a lot of this comes because the pot of money is up here, and the decision is to make down here. And we need to get those things located together, so that people that make decisions at the local government that they're going to give expensive packages to police, fire, or city managers or whatever, they got to pay for it all, you know, so that they understand there are consequences, that they're not feeding from a common pool. So those are kind of things that we have to do. Now, lastly, what are the chances of doing some of these things? Well, the deliberative poll that the Stanford people ran suggested that some of these things are doable. The legislative capacity parts are doable. We'll see whether initiative reform is possible when this proposal to move all initiatives to the November ballot, which is a system we used to have prior to the 70s, whether that moves forward or not, or whether the initiative industry is just too powerful and just blocks it. So we'll get a test of that. I think the tax reform and the local government restructuring, of the two, I think maybe local government restructuring has a shot. But again, it's hard to tell what Jerry Brown is going to do next, because if you read what's in the papers, he claims to be demoralized and shocked that the Republicans have acted in the kind of intransigent way that they have, and that they're not willing to entertain his ideas. I can understand why Jerry's discouraged, but there's no way that a man who's been in government and been as continuously as Jerry Brown should be completely fooled at that kind of intransigence. It's one thing for Obama, who was a community organizer and, shall we say, probably didn't have the kind of experience that you would want in a president. It's one thing for Obama to be learning his lessons on the job. It's another thing for Jerry Brown, who's been around a long time, to suddenly realize that, you know, maybe the Republicans aren't going to give him any breaks whatsoever. I think I would have gone in expecting that. But anyway. So I want to finish with one thing, which is political scientists, professional reformers like California Forward, like to think that you can engineer a solution with some clever tweak of the law or political institutions. And there's something to be said for that point of view. There are things that you can do that on the margin push the system that way or push the system this way. But I think we oversell the idea that fixing the apparatus of government is going to solve the problems of a society. I think we have a difficult sociology in America right now. We have rising partisanship. We have increasingly polarized media. We have the highest levels of income inequality since the post-war. We have rising levels of insecurity. We have racial tensions as a result of immigration and people's reaction to it. This is a very volatile mix of things. And it's not clear that there's any perfect set of rules that's going to solve all the problems when a society is divided evenly between people that have different conceptions of government, or it's divided in many different parts by different views about race, etc. And in the end, there has to be better citizenship. There has to be better sociology. There has to be better politics. There has to be a better understanding that negotiation starts at the grassroots. It's not simply imposed by the people at the top. The people on the top probably are the last people to get around to it, because, you know, you can't get elected to office if you don't have money. You don't have money unless you go to the interest groups who are going to give you the money. They're not going to give you the money, whether it's labor or chamber of commerce, if you don't do what they want. So, you know, the polarization started with the elected officials, but now it's infecting down into the citizenship. And our social sorting and our media sorting and the rest are leading to a world in which we interact with people that are different from us as infrequently as possible. We listen to the views of people that disagree with us as infrequently as possible. And the idea of being a compromiser or looking for some sort of agreement is squishy and soft. Well, you know, if we don't fix that underlying culture, I don't care how clever the rules are, they're not going to solve the problems of the society. So I would suggest that while engineering is a good thing, I think we need to look to ourselves and to our sociology and the way we're thinking about our discussions, how we communicate with one another, that has to be fixed as well, or the political solutions won't work. So on that cheery note, I will open it up to questions about this or anything else that may be on your mind, particularly if somebody has a cheery question.
First, I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that you're listening to Professor Bruce Cain speaking about the dysfunction of government in California. And now we're opening up for questions and answers. Who would like to ask the first question?
You touched on the economic situation in the country and also the skewed income distribution. And I attended a prior talk by Professor Reich here at the Commonwealth Club where he kind of talked about the skewed income distribution as being kind of at the bedrock of the economic situation we have in this country. So in your time in Washington with Brookings and all the others, are you hearing anything about a movement to try to even out that income distribution?
I think that's sort of the cutting edge dialogue right now about taxes, right? There's no question that the economists at Brookings, for example, absolutely believe there's no way that you're going to solve the debt crisis by simply cutting. We're at $14 trillion. We're going to incur more debt if the Obama, any aspects of the Obama plan go forward. And so they say there's no question you have to get more revenue, and the revenue has to come from the upper levels. But that's a hard discussion to have, and I was listening to Governor Rendell at Brookings last week, a former governor of Pennsylvania, and he spends a lot of time debating Republicans on various media channels, and he was talking about how Grover Norquist and others keep talking about how we have the highest corporate tax rates in the world, and they keep repeating that. And Governor Rendell says, no, actually, our effective tax rate, what they actually pay, is about half of the 35% they're supposed to pay. And so it's not a honest way to talk about taxes. We should be talking about what people effectively pay, not what the actual nominal tax rate is. And Grover Norquist says, yeah, but the nominal rate is 35%, and he keeps coming back to that. So there's no question that, at least on the Democratic side, there's a real recognition that the inequality has to be addressed. Robert Reich believes, and I think he's right, that we also have to look at the security issue. That is that if we're really going to be moving people into pension systems that are on 401ks, Lord knows, with the volatility of the markets, that we're setting ourselves up for some people to not be able to retire. Certainly in the university system, and I'm sure in the rest of the system, there were a whole bunch of people that were planning, professors that were planning to retire on their 401ks, and, when it dropped a third or more, they're going to reassess their decision about whether to retire, which then clogs up the ranks for the young people that are looking for jobs. So, all these are very, very important issues. They're aware of it, but there's a fundamental divide about what to do about it. And, given the way the politics is right now, I think it's going to be very hard for, a substantial tax reform to happen. The super committee seems to be paralyzed. The one thing that's possible is that Obama can allow the Bush tax cuts to lapse, but if he allows them to lapse, he needs Congress to participate in restructuring so it only hits the people above 250,000. If the Republicans decide not to cooperate at all, then the tax cut will go across the spectrum, and Lord knows what the reaction will be at that point.
The tax issue is only part of it. I mean, you look at the attrition of the manufacturing sector,
right,
which the jobs tend to pay better. Union movement,
right,
on the decline, and replacement with lower paid service sector jobs, and that has a lot to do with.
No, absolutely, and to be honest, I don't. What I heard is the green jobs dream. And that is really killing the Democrats right now, because it probably wasn't realistic to start with, and it certainly hasn't been realized. Whether it didn't get realized because they made bad decisions or because the general state of the economy was you just made it impossible to push forward, who knows? But this Solyndra issue is going to kill the Democrats in a lot of different ways. First of all, it has elements of crony capitalism, which is something you could have used against Rick Perry or the Republicans, but now it seems like aspects of crony capitalism are involved in the Solyndra thing. It goes right to the issue the Republicans make about a government-led industrial strategy, because what they say is you shouldn't be picking winners or losers because you're not going to do it on the grounds of economic efficiency. You're going to do it because of political influence. And what does Solyndra give us? Exhibit A of the fact that it's quite possible that political pressure and lobbying was the reason that this firm got the $500 million when they had a technology that was clearly not selling. It was too expensive. It was being undercut by what the Chinese were doing, and they already had inventory that was lying around. Well, you look at all that and you go, well, how did we make such a stupid decision? And you realize that there was a lot of political pressure to sell the green economy. So the problem is, can you actually have an industrial policy when the American political system is so captured by special interests and money? It's one thing if this was the Soviet Union or China even, where, you know, you've got a bunch of tyrants that aren't beholden to special interests. They're just going to do what they want. And, you know, so it's a lot easier for the Chinese government to make decisions that even consumers in China wouldn't choose. That is, they've had an enforced savings rate that they probably wouldn't choose if they had a true democracy. So China has the advantage of not being a democracy. We have the disadvantage that we are a democracy, and it's kind of a very special crony democracy. So I don't know. There are great ideas, but can the government lead those ideas? You know, do we know how to move forward on that without, you know, stepping on our own feet? You know, we're probably going to ricochet in the opposite direction. You know, we're going to go back to a completely deregulated world where the government, I doubt that we'll go to a world where the government isn't making choices. It's just they'll be making choices about defense contractors rather than green technology. So it'll be a different form of government-led capitalism. So the answer is there is no good vision out there in Washington. People don't have an idea. They all see exactly what you're talking about. They see the problem. They see that the banking sector was too big. They see that we're giving away manufacturing. They see all these problems. But do they have a way forward that combines economic analysis with realistic political analysis? No, they don't.
I'd like to ask a question related to your comment about the fact that it's difficult to make changes in the states. And it seems like actually in some states the things are moving backwards. And I take the Electoral College as an example. Mm-hmm. Some states want to reform to have it a popular vote. Other states are moving to tie the electoral votes to a gerrymandered congressional districts,
right,
which is sort of going backwards in this reform process or this change process. Could you comment on that, Simon?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're stuck with a system that may have made sense at one point in history when we were early coming together as a nation, but now we're stuck with it because of basically the Senate and the Electoral College don't conform to one person, one vote principles. So some of what you're seeing is a sincere effort on the part of some people in the reform community to take unilateral action and hope that everybody else will follow along and it will bypass the very arduous supermajority laborious system of constitutional change. So the idea is, well, we can't do that. That takes too long. We'd have to get the Congress to agree, and the Senate will filibuster it, and then we'd have to go out and get all these state legislatures to agree. It's not going to work. So let's try something now that we can do, which is to work with our state legislatures and pass something. So that's one element of it. But the other element of it is what I was talking about before, which is that the reform process has been captured by people who see short-term political advantage. And so this push in Pennsylvania to switch to the system is motivated by Republican operatives who cleverly see that if Pennsylvania, which is a swing state that might be won by Obama, has to split its electoral votes, that this could make the difference between Obama winning the election versus Perry, Romney, whoever. So you have some sincere people who think we got to do something, and you've got some strategic people who think, yeah, I'll encourage them. And but, you know, you're not going to see Texas. You're not going to see red states doing it. There was an attempt to do the same thing in California, and you know, people in California said, well, wait a minute, well, sure, we'll do it if everybody does it, but there's a real problem, first-mover problem. If we go first, then our side, either Democrats or Republicans, are going to be hurt by that. So you can't get around it. It has to be a reform that every state accepts at the same time. And, you know, but in order to do that, you have to get the small states that already benefit from the system to agree with it. So it's we're kind of locked into a system which we all believe is not doesn't work for us, but we can't overcome the political obstacles to changing it.
Going back to the four things we're thinking about, are there any efforts that people like us can participate in or that have started in any of those four areas that are sort of ongoing?
Yeah, I think actually the California Forward people are looking at the legislative capacity ones that I suggested. I think they're cautiously moving forward on the initiative changes. But I think the other issues are just really difficult politically. And so when I think reform groups like California Forward, they have the following insight, which is correct, which is no reform is going to go forward unless it's truly bipartisan. But because it has to be truly bipartisan, it takes a while for everybody to agree what you're going to do, and then you have to go to the legislature first, see if they're interested. If they're not, then you've got to decide whether you can raise the money and put it on the ballot and convince people to vote for it. And that's an expensive proposition. But I think they're the people that early on, while the Bay Area Council was trying to do this complete blow-up-the-boxes approach, they've been the ones all along that said, no, you know, it may not be ideal to have to compromise with the other side, but let's do a bipartisan agreement about change and only do those things that we agree to. By definition, when you do that, you're not going to be making the kind of transformative changes that some people would want, but at least you're trying to make some incremental steps forward. And that's, I think, probably the best effort that we have going on in the state right now.
Some of you may have heard Professor Fishkin from Deliberative Democracy at Stanford speak here in June, because we had him come to talk about the program that he had.
Mm-hmm.
Switching back to the national level for a second, as a person who works as a volunteer on retiree issues, there's a significant amount of potential savings in Medicare if the Republicans would join the party, for example, in allowing Medicare to negotiate with the drug companies to allow for reimportation of drugs.
Right.
And I just saw an email the other day that showed that the only Republicans that are even willing to co-sponsor such legislation are Snow and Grassley, who are very much on the margins. And yet the Republicans say they want to help the deficit. Because right now, the VA can negotiate with the drug companies, and they're paying 30-40% less for the same drug that the Medicare people are paying.
Yeah. Well, this, of course, was an issue that came up in the last election, and And one of the hilarious things was we discovered that Sarah Palin took her family to Canada, or her family took her to Canada to do health care and, you know, and buy drugs over there. So, yeah, I mean, it's, again, this is the frustrating thing. And that's why, you know, the drug companies are extremely powerful. And, you know, here's the story. I'm not one of these people who thinks that people are bought and sold in the sense that they change their views because there's money on the table for campaign contributions. That's not how it works. And I think the reform community has done us a disservice by talking about it as if it's quid pro quo corruption and people are enriching themselves. There's an aspect of that, but that's not really what's going on. What's really going on is that the inertia has its roots in the money system. And it's the inertia of the money that really is killing us. In other words, the money tends to follow the support. So if you have been voting for the drug companies or the banks, you're going to get more money. They don't go out and try to persuade a Barney Frank or somebody to switch their vote. They're not going to do that. They're just going to support their friends. And the more they support their friends, the more they cement that inertial factor into the system. So, you know, this is something I'm actually writing a book about, political reform, and this is one of my critiques, is that we use the word corruption too broadly, and so people get a confused idea about what's really going on. It's not really corruption per se. What it is a distortion of the system caused by the dependence of legislators on these groups for resources in order to get reelected. So it's distortion. It robs them of their independence of thinking, and it creates these inertial forces. And, you know, that's why you know, you can do the top two and you can do redistricting reform, but in the end, you know, the fundamental way the whole system operates and the money that is so important to the system really prevents the kind of fundamental thing you're talking about, which is, look, you know, we can save money if we can negotiate, if we can, you know, we can buy the drugs cheaper. But, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is extremely powerful in D.C. If you look at the spending, you go on to, you know, the various sites that list who year after year give enormous amount of money, you see some variation that when a particular bill is before the Congress, you'll see some fluctuation in the spending. But year after year, the pharmaceutical industry is up there in the top five, top ten, in terms of their spending. So, you know, that's what makes it hard.
On the University of California, I mean, given the staggering cuts that you've talked about, and given that President Udoff has said right in this room and other places that the model for funding public higher education, not just in California but in the country, is broken. Because there are other great public universities like Wisconsin and Michigan, and like, as you know, of course, that are suffering. What new model do you see any chance of working towards?
Yeah, that is exactly the question that we're struggling with on a day-to-day basis at the University of California. And it's a difficult category because these public-private institutions are the ones that have gotten us in so much trouble. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are examples. I mean, they had a public mandate, which was to sort of expand home ownership to the broadest level possible, and then they had a private mandate, which was to maximize profits. And or the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian had a scandal 4 or 5 years ago where they were trying to become profit-making, but at the same time, they're a public institution that's supposed to be keeping the doors open and providing cultural background for us. And so here we are in the same situation. We're a public-private institution. This year, the amount of money that we get from fees will exceed the amount of money that we get from the state. The University of California, Berkeley, will have 14% of its revenues coming from the state, 14%. The legislature thinks of us as a public institution, but when you're only paying 14% of the bill, that's a little presumptuous, you know. So how do we struggle with that? I'd like to think that we will retain a public mission, that we will look at California and say that we have an element of public service that we are trying to educate as broadly as possible students from the middle classes and lower income groups, that we will not become Stanford or USC and just simply look for the students that can pay. We will try to provide research and knowledge that is useful to the state as a whole and not ignore the state and just focus on national and international issues. But it's hard. And what I see right now is that we're so obsessed with just making ourselves survive that nobody's looking past this month, this year, this budget, figuring out how many people to let go, figuring out how to take the new tasks on, figuring out teaching loads. We're just struggling to stay alive because you don't get hit with a $750 million shift without your world changing so dramatically that you really are kind of, if you like, discombobulated and unsure of how to act on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, my center is a good example of that. We basically now have given up every cent of public money that we have, and we're totally run on private fees, and we have no endowment. So I'm basically running a small business. I have to make sure that I get enough students to pay my staff, and I have to worry about whether I can pay the debt service on the building, and it's totally up to me, and I'm a professor, you know, and I've been asked to be a small businessman. Well, you know, I'm learning, but, you know, something's lost in all this, you know, but it is the world we are in. Yes.
My question is regarding the desirability of California bonds, particularly at this point since the government is about to put in the long-term, meaning from 6 years to 30-year changes in terms of lowering rates. Even on the all-states bonds, California represents a significant portion mm-hmm. of the investment. How do you feel in terms of California bonds in general?
Investment advice from a professor of political science?
This might have not been the place to ask the question, but I would have been very annoyed with myself had I walked out and then somebody would say to me, why in the world didn't you ask the question?
Yeah, well, I think you know more about the subject than I do is the problem. But it's a good question, and I wish I had more expertise in that. I am confident that in the long run, the economy will eventually recover and that we will meet all of our bond expenses. I think it's unlikely that we're going to default. If we're defaulting, it's because Europe has completely failed and we sink back into something worse than 2008 and the whole country as a whole is failing. Which right now is not what most people are saying in D.C. and among the economists. They see it as more likely that we're going to stay in a pattern of sort of frozen credit and slow investment and people holding on to things and overlearning the lessons last time. So I can't tell you good investment decisions, but I do think in the long run California will live up to its obligations and that the bonds will probably do fine. But beyond that, I think you have better answers than I do. Yeah.
Well, we have time for one or two more questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you haven't talked about the reluctance of people to raise taxes.
Right.
I feel that people want services. They should be willing to pay for them. Nothing is free. And it certainly seems that every time taxes being raised is discussed, the Republicans manage to turn it off, and I think we need to raise taxes. And how do you think they're being so successful at this?
I think there are two secrets to their success. Number one is that people don't really know what it's going to take to get out of this recession. And if a bunch of business people and bankers and others say that raising taxes will stall out the economy and increase the level of unemployment, your average citizen isn't going to have the expertise in macroeconomics to disagree. Plus, I will point out that your average citizen tends to employ their own intuitions about how they do their finances and project it onto the government. And so in their own lives, if they're struggling with debts, they're going to save more and they're going to cut back. And so it's very hard for them to understand Keynesian economics and understand the need to counter deflationary pressures. That's just not intuitively obvious to a lot of people. So I think part of the problem with the taxes is that people are worried, the American public is worried that if you increase taxes, small businesses will be hurt, and that will be the line that the Republicans will push. But I think the other problem is the one that I alluded to, which is that it's just putting up the rates a few percentage points doesn't get at the real problem, which is that we've got a broken system of taxation, both at the state level and the federal level, that a lot of people aren't paying the nominal rates, that there are a lot of loopholes out there. And this is, of course, an issue that Obama has sort of made personal by taking Warren Buffett as an example, and we're going to hear a lot about that through the campaign. But the idea is that, it's one thing to have nominal rates of 35, 37, whatever we're talking about, and it's all right to say, but if in fact people aren't even paying that rate, maybe you ought to be addressing that problem as well. So, the only thing I can say is that there do seem to be some Republicans that have an interest in looking at tax policy. And the hopeful scenario for this super committee is that faced with the prospect that the super committee, that the Obama cuts are going to, extension of tax cuts, Bush tax cuts is up for expiration, that there might be some trade. The Republicans would say, well, we don't want that, but we'll trade some closing of loopholes. But that was the dream about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Right now, I think people think the whole thing is stalled out. So that's the problem with respect to taxes.
Everything you've said is
right.
I think the fault of the media to present us, with very few exceptions, the media to present us with facts.
Yeah.
And is there anything you can do as being part of the media to get the print and radio TV media to, instead of presenting their own opinions, giving us facts?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm used by the media. I'm not in the media. I'm a humble college professor. The whole situation with the media is very worrisome. If I asked how many of you subscribe to newspapers, a majority of you would do that. If I asked a comparable sized group of people under the age of 30 the same question, nobody would raise their hand. Now, that isn't to say that they aren't reading the media, but it is to say they don't want to pay for it. And so as a result, as you say, we now have more blogging and more opining, and the economic model for sincere, validated, sourced news is dwindling. And right now you talk to people in the journalism world and they have no idea how to fix it. I think the question, you can't give it away. They've got to figure out a way to get that back. And, and we already see that now people are, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are talking about putting things behind. The Wall Street Journal is behind a paywall. I think the New York Times has done that too, as I recall. I get mine in print at home and I get ink all over my fingers. But, so I do think that, finding a way to monetize this is a key element in this. But the real problem that you're getting at, and I'll finish with this, is not there are people that are out there doing independent, good reporting. The problem is twofold. One, there's been a proliferation of people that don't do that, that just do, the O'Reilly / the left-wing versions of it too, of opinion making. But the The media. I lost my thought for a second here. Oh well, I aside from monetizing it, the media is going to have to figure out a way. Right now, people are sort of burrowing into little channels of their own world, and you can become extremely deep about a given topic. And I see this with the students, that you really, following links can get all the way down into topics. But what you're not getting is across the board. So people become very narrow-casted. And I'm not sure what the answer to that's going to be, because quite apart from whether you've got an economic model of this, the availability of kind of narrow-casting is really changing the way citizenship works. And so I'm not sure what the answer to that's going to be. And then lastly, I would say that you talk to the established media about what it takes to get ahead, and they will tell you that you have to play up the drama, in order to get on the front page or to get the story. And so you're right, they do sort of push things to the dramatic, and they do exaggerate, but that's because they believe that that's what people want, and that news that's not conflictual is not entertaining, and that I agree with you, is a real problem.
I think one other element to that media issue, and it comes to the politics of why we're a 50-50 red state, blue state thing, is with all the money going into the advertising, that is, and the finances for the media going down in every other way, this is, it's in their interest to make sure that the elections are as close as possible so that more ads are run. you could watch, when Clinton was way ahead of Obama in the primaries, the media attention went to Obama and made him a real contender. And when he pushed in front of Clinton, they started to switch around the other way so that the race was close all the way to the end. That's really to keep the money flowing. So
yeah.
One last question.
No.
It sounds like you could be in support of campaign finance reform, and if so, what form would you see that taking?
Well, the problem with campaign finance reform is that the U.S. Constitution has been interpreted ways that makes makes campaign finance reform virtually impossible, because what the court has said is that giving money or spending money on behalf of a candidate is a constitutional right. It's a First Amendment right. And the only reason that you can legitimately restrict that right is if there is a danger of corruption. And so basically, candidates can spend as much money as they want because they can't corrupt themselves. People can spend independently, i.e. not coordinate with a candidate, and create super PACs or independent expenditure committees because there's no quid pro quo exchange. You're spending the money independently. You can't force people to do public finance, says the court, because, expenditures don't corrupt. And so the only way you could make a public financing system work is to force people to use the public money. And the court says you can't do that. The only thing you can do is ask people to pretty please take the public money and forego the right to spend as much money as they want. And as you saw Obama last time, and probably Rick Perry or Romney this time, all of them will probably not take the public money because the amount of money that you get is not enough to win. And so they're going to say, forget that, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to raise the money by myself. So would campaign finance reform make a difference in this country? Yes. Is it likely to happen? No. Unless you change the Supreme Court and overturn precedent, and that's not going to happen anytime soon, if at all.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Cain.
Sure.
And we thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our online and radio audiences. And so ends another event in the 108-year history of the Commonwealth Club of California.